The House now comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Kerry Taupō-Allen.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, today Statistics New Zealand released GDP data for the March quarter, showing the initial impacts of COVID-19 on the economy as we moved early to close our borders and put public health measures in place to protect New Zealanders. The data showed GDP fell 1.6% in the March quarter from December, within the range of economists' expectations. Annual average GDP was up 1.5% from a year ago. We have always acknowledged that GDP in the March and June quarters in particular will show the impacts of the public health measures to protect New Zealand from the global COVID-19 pandemic. It is these measures which have allowed us to open up the economy more quickly than planned and given us a head start on our recovery compared to many other countries in the world.
How did the global COVID-19 pandemic and public health measures affect different industries in the economy?
Mr. Speaker, our measures to protect New Zealand from the global pandemic started on February 3rd when all foreign nationals travelling from or transiting through China were refused entry through our borders. Moves to close our borders on 19 March, move to level 3 on 24 March and level 4 on 26 March all had an impact on GDP. Activity in the accommodation, restaurant and bar industries declined 7.8% during the quarter, while exports in terms of travel services declined 8.5% as fewer tourists entered New Zealand. We also saw the impact of the glut of European logs going into China, which led to activity in the forestry and logging industry declining 5.2%, while we also have to bear in mind that the drought at the start of the year was also having an impact in the agriculture sector, which fell 0.3%.
Supplementary, sir. What is the outlook for the economy from here?
Mr Speaker, we know that the current June quarter will see the biggest impact on GDP of COVID-19, reflecting the alert level 4 measures through April as well as alert level 3. This backwards-looking data will be released in September. The Secretary to the Treasury yesterday advised the Finance and Expenditure Committee that its outlook has changed since the budget forecast. The Treasury said the move to alert level 1 sooner than expected has meant increased economic activity and said the early indications are that activity had held up better than expected in the June quarter, but they warned about the global outlook deteriorating. Today, Kiwi Bank indicated that beyond the September quarter, there is a growing sense, albeit small, that the outlook is looking brighter. New Zealand got on top of COVID-19 much sooner than most had expected, allowing the rapid reopening of the economy. Kiwi Bank have said they've been buoyed by the strength and the rebound of spending amongst their own customers and that New Zealand will avoid the worst-case scenarios.
Question number two, the Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Question to the Prime Minister. Does she have confidence in her Minister of Health's management of the COVID-19 response, given the implications it has on the health and finances of New Zealanders?
Right Honourable Winston Peters.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes, this government is adamantly focused on addressing failures in the system and removing risk. Unlike those who are calling for international students to flow through our borders without adequate preparation, have made all sorts of comments about the government failing to make steps and protocols of safety available to 5 million New Zealanders. Their error was an unacceptable failure, and for that reason we've appointed Air Commodore Darren Webb to lead the quarantine efforts, and we have halted compassionate leave for isolation until we can be certain that proper procedures will be followed in each and every case.
Supplementary question. If she has confidence in her Minister of Health, why did she take the unprecedented step to send in the Defence Force instead of letting her own minister manage the COVID-19 response?
Because for those who know the real world, if you're looking for people to handle logistical matters, then the Defence Force would be the most trained in this country. Well, as I say again, Minister, you've asked the question. Honourable Kaye, if you've asked the question, do you want an answer or not? Or are we going to have you chipping away and telling us what you don't know? My answer? Well, I'll answer the question. If anybody over there wants an answer, keep quiet. Well, you clearly don't then.
Supplementary question. Can she personally guarantee that David Clark has managed the COVID-19 response competently, and therefore will she guarantee that we will see no further serious errors relating to quarantine management?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the Minister of Health has laid out with his colleagues and the all of government response the protocols to be followed. We said at the beginning there would be human error and mistakes. That's what life is like. But it surely is not the responsibility of a minister who lays out the protocol for people in their thousands to follow when some person fails to follow that protocol. We want 5 million New Zealanders to be part of the front line in our defence, and we're saying again, this is an unacceptable failure, and we're going to do and make sure that we eliminate that as much as possible. But remember at the very beginning, as we were moving 130,000 plus people in and out of this country, we did say there would be some mistakes.
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
To the Prime Minister, is it her expectation that the Minister of Health will personally supervise the admission to and exit from quarantine, as seems to be suggested by the opposition?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, that's a very, very good question, because it just demonstrates, not being pedantic, it demonstrates a perverse mind that doesn't understand a thing called fairness or reasonableness. That's what it displays, and that member from the Hamilton area that no one knows can keep on shouting at the back. That's why he's there, because he's not worth promoting. The reality is the Minister of Health cannot surely be responsible any more than the Director General for a human failure down the bottom. But our job is to, as I say, enlist the help of 5 million New Zealanders and ensure that the law and the protocols are followed. Can I just say, I'm hearing members shouting out here like Judith Collins, who said there was an appalling that the government declined compassion leave. There is something very wrong in that decision-making, and we need to have it sorted. That's Judith Collins. I've got countless quotes from these people over here shouting for the very thing to happen that we have sought not to happen.
Supplementary question. Who will take responsibility for the quarantine management failures in this situation?
The reality is that there is a full-scale investigation as to how it happened, and those people will take responsibility. Can I just say, this is alongside a Member of Parliament who got information, knowing full well that the plea was, tell the authorities as soon as you get the information, because every minute, every hour counts. And what did he do? Rather than tell the authorities, he thought he'd wait to question time in Parliament. And all those valuable hours were lost. Or can I just quote another person who's now critical and shouting out as well? He said, the absolute priority must be to get those students back for the second semester, and yet we're fluffing around, not making much progress on that. Who said that? Oh, it's accountability, isn't it? I said, who said it? That's how much they talk to each other. Mr. Goldsmith said that.
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Have there been instances where members of Parliament, including opposition members of Parliament, have made personal representations urging for people to be released from quarantine early?
Order!
Well, I think this quote comes from somebody who fits that description. And he said, quotes, I think the symbolism of not being able to attend friends, relatives and very, very close loved ones' funerals is a big problem. I think it's heartless, it's cold, and it's nowhere near kind. Guess who said that? Jerry Brownlee.
Supplementary question. Why is she happy to front the world and receive the credit
for New Zealand's order? And a member.
I'm going to allow the member to rephrase her question in a way that she knows is in order rather than as she knows is out of order.
Supplementary question. Why is she happy to take the credit?
Order. The Prime Minister's happiness is not a matter for responsibility of the House. Goodness sake.
Supplementary question. Why does she take the credit for the COVID-19 response and the accolades from the rest of the world, but when things go wrong, she is nowhere to be seen?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, like the previous Prime Ministers in this country, I'm not usually here on a Thursday. However, I've got full confidence in my colleagues who are here. because it'll be like taking candy off a baby. Now, can I just say this here? This is coming from a Member of Parliament whose leader said this, that the government should bring in people from China as a matter of urgency, and now is trying to claim he wants a stronger border. Make up their collective minds.
Supplementary question. Was her confidence in the minister reduced the most when he personally broke New Zealand's lockdown 3 times, or when he presided over the catalogue of failures around New Zealand's quarantine management?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the Minister for Health has given an apology, and a very effusive one at that, and that has been accepted. And the Prime Minister, as Prime Minister, I do understand that human error sometimes happens, and as long as it's a sincere error and can be corrected, then that should be accepted as well. But here's the real point. We moved as a country and as a government 130,000 plus around the world, 80,000 back to New Zealand against medical advice, and 60,000 plus out of New Zealand to keep our international connections going, and we minimised the risk as much as possible. But we did say there would be examples of failure. Now, to stand up today and say there'll be no more failure is to be ridiculous. Our job is to, as much as we can, possibly and probably get the protocols properly put into place and ensure that we minimise the chance of failure.
Supplementary question. How many cases, if any, has she been briefed on where the government's quarantine or testing processes have not been followed?
Well, on behalf of the Prime Minister, all the cases that I was briefed on, I was briefed on.
How many? Supplementary question. How many cases...
A point of order.
Speaker, there's somebody out there shouting out, how many? Well, if you say all the cases I was briefed on, it means 100%.
Yes, I know, but there's no responsibility on the part of the Prime Minister to respond to inane interjections.
Asking how many is the name?
Supplementary question. How many cases, if any, has she been briefed on where the government... quarantine or testing procedures have not been followed?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I had no idea I'd come down the House today and be asked that question. If that was of concern, some notice, an hour's notice or 2 hours' notice, we'd be down here with a precise number. But to expect the Prime Minister to come down here and be asked to answer inane questions like that, how many, when it could be hundreds, it could be... Given that there was over 1,500 cases... The answer to that is more than 1,500.
Supplementary question. At what time yesterday did David Clark inform her that her statement that the two COVID-19 cases have not come into contact with anyone since leaving managed isolation other than their parent as their, per their release plan was incorrect?
The answer on behalf of the Prime Minister, when he discovered that the information was incorrect.
A point of order, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Mr Speaker, the Prime Minister's answer there did not address the question. It didn't ask for the conditions, it asked for the time. If the Prime Minister isn't able to answer the question, that's fine, but that is not an answer to the question.
I think it was, yep.
Supplementary question. What would it take for her to lose confidence in David Clark and sack him, given he's overseen failures around Avatar crew, failures in testing, and people absconding from quarantine and the return of COVID-19 to New Zealand?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, it is very, very sad that we're witnessing, in the case of this nation's safety and health, by way of analogy, the behaviour of an African veld, when a lion comes out of the field and attacks one animal. They all are running flat tack, but the moment one gets taken, they all stop and start eating and grazing again. We expect a higher standard of behaviour. We expect a higher standard of behaviour when our nation's health is of concern. And to turn this round on a personal attack for some flimsy, paltry political advantage is very, very sad.
Supplementary question. Who will take responsibility for the serious errors in quarantine management and testing in New Zealand?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the Director General already has And in the end, though, we will find... Big Ben? Well, there'll be nobody who takes responsibility or blame for him. Can I just say, Mr. Smith, that the fact is that we're going to find those people at the coalface who didn't follow the protocols. The only way we can eliminate this sort of irresponsible behaviour or failure to fulfil the protocol requirements is to identify those people and make sure that doesn't, as much as possible, happen again.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Can the Prime Minister confirm reports that the Leader of the Opposition, when asked whether or not he would sack a Minister of Health if he ever became the Prime Minister because of an official's mistake, said no?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes, I heard that. Given what his colleagues are streaming out for today, there's a word for that, and it starts with H and ends with Y, but I can't say it.
Question number three, the Honourable Amy Adams.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What is the most recent advice he has received from the Treasury on the likely impact of COVID-19 on the New Zealand economy over the period to 30 June 2021? And what impact does he think this will have on New Zealand households?
Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, the latest advice I have received from the Treasury is reflected in the statement made by the Secretary of the Treasury to the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee yesterday. In that advice, the Treasury says its outlook has changed since the budget because of three developments. Firstly, that we have moved to level one sooner than expected, increasing economic activity with people getting back to work. Second, June quarter activity looks to have held up better than expected. And thirdly, in less positive news, the global outlook is weaker. On balance, the Treasury suggests that this indicates near-term improvement on their budget forecasts and a slower recovery in the long term due to the global outlook. In answer to the second part of the question, the impact on specific households will be different for each, but the measures the government has put in place will cushion the blow of the impact of this 1-in-100-year global pandemic.
Supplementary. How many New Zealanders does the Minister think will struggle to pay their bills as a result of the level of economic decline outlined by the Treasury, the Reserve Bank and a range of others, when today's GDP fall already represents an average drop of $13,000 for every household?
Mr. Speaker, far fewer than would be struggling if it weren't for the measures that the government took in terms of the wage subsidy cap scheme, the support for small businesses, the support for sectors like tourism.
Supplementary. Does the Minister think that the 400% increase in people now queuing up for food parcels really believe that this government's actions are supporting them through this crisis?
Mr. Speaker, what I know that many of those people will be grateful for is the fact that the government on the 17th of March increased main benefits by $25 per week, doubled the winter energy payment, made sure that there were services available through the civil defence and emergency management arrangements to ensure people did get food parcels and did get what they needed, funded Whanauora for over $100 million to make sure that people actually got what they needed, a range of measures which the National Opposition in large part opposed.
How many more New Zealanders are out of work today compared to at the start of the year when you include those who don't qualify for job seeker support?
Mr. Speaker, in terms of the numbers around job support, it's approximately 45,000 since the period of COVID anyway coming into being. And in addition to that, I'd need to get back to the member on the exact information on those who've got the COVID income relief payment, which will include those who weren't eligible.
Well, how many jobs could have been saved if the construction sector, who were the biggest contributor to today's GDP decline, hadn't been fully shut down by the Minister?
The member is incorrect in terms of the impact on different sectors that is noted in today's GDP. What I can say to the member is that...
Order. We accept that there's a certain amount of provocation in the question, but I want to hear the answer, and our colleagues, right from the usual suspects, down to the normally quieter ones are making too much noise.
Mr Speaker, as I was saying, the construction sector, yes, it did see a drop. There were other sectors affected by things such as border closures that suffered a larger drop. So in that respect, the member's question is incorrect. In terms of where we are today, New Zealand's economy is operating at a higher level than most other countries in the world because we went hard and early, because we said we would do this once and do it right. That allows us now to have an economy that is operating ahead of most other countries.
Supplementary. How can New Zealand have any confidence in this government's economic management of the biggest economic crisis in a generation when the minister can't answer straight questions about job losses so far? And in the first 3 months of this crisis, New Zealand has already experienced 5 times more economic damage than Australia.
Mr Speaker, the member's question I actually think does a disservice to the 5 million New Zealanders who actually endorsed the government's strategy up to about 90%, I think, to go hard, to go early, to do this once and to do it right. Yes, there is an impact in the March quarter data. Yes, there will be an impact in the June quarter data. But New Zealanders have backed this government because we have a plan to deal with COVID-19.
Kerry McAnulty.
To the Minister, has he seen reports of any groups calling for, at the same time, more spending, less debt, open borders, closed borders and open industry?
Mr Speaker, yes, I have. I've seen one particular group of people in utter state of confusion about those matters. And in the case of some members on the other side, they've managed to do all of those things themselves.
Order.
Question number 4, Derek Ball.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for State-Owned Enterprises. Does he stand by all of his actions relating to investment in Kiwi Rail?
The Right Honourable Winston.
Yes, I humbly do, particularly those concerning projects which promised to revitalise New Zealand regions. Last week, we visited the Whangarei Freight Terminal with my colleague, Shane Jones. We had the pleasure of meeting many of the people who work on a critical part of New Zealand's infrastructure, which has been neglected and run down for far too long. It included seeing the welding of new heavy rail lines of 75 metres in length, the cartage of them down to the railway lines all the way to the tunnels, and also the plans to lower the tunnels between Whangarei and Auckland. That represents huge investment and a harbinger of enormous economic recovery for Northland when these things are running properly.
Supplementary. How much in total has this government invested in New Zealand's railways?
Mr Speaker, $4.6
billion,
which includes $350 million for improvements to Wiri to Key Park Corridor, $371 million to extend electrification from Papakura to Pukekohe, $211 million for improvements to the Wellington, Wairarapa and Palmerston North networks. But hang on, there's more. $400 million for the Inter-Islander ferry replacement, $247 million for the Drury and Associated Railway stations, and $6.2 million for the Napier to Wairoa Railway. And there's no doubt that railways has got a new sense of action and unction. Thank you.
Supplementary. How will these investments in rail help create jobs for New Zealanders?
Jobs.
Thank you very much for that question, because the government's recovery plan is based on business and jobs. And as part of the recent Provincial Growth Fund reset, again spearheaded by my colleague Shane Jones, $60 million were announced that focus specifically on worker redeployment. That includes $26 million for rail projects, which will focus on maintaining existing lines which lay neglected and overgrown, under the purview of the previous government. That investment will create shovel-ready jobs for hundreds and hundreds of people. This government is jobs-focused, and that's why we're making sure that employment is a core factor of our decision-making when we make our investments in New Zealand railways. And the great news is these investments will be around from 50 to 100 years' time.
Yeah. Jobs. Question number 5, the Honourable Michael Waterhouse.
Oh, thank you. My question is to the Minister of Health. Did he intend for the COVID-19 Public Health Response Act 2020 to provide for the mandatory testing of certain individuals?
If so, was the Director General of Health referring to mandatory testing when he said on 9 June, quote, from today, everyone in managed isolation will be tested twice during that period, whether they have symptoms or not, around day 3 and around day 12, end quote.
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The COVID-19 Public Health Response Act 2020 provides that orders can be made under the Act to require persons to report for medical examination or testing, section 1118. That Act maintained the 9 April 2020 section 70 order under the Health Act 1956 by the Director General of Health, which includes requirements for mandatory testing.
So if testing is mandatory, or can be mandatory rather, why were people in managed isolation giving them information, advising them of their right to refuse a test?
Mr. Speaker, that is something I have requested answers for because I find it unacceptable.
So are all individuals in managed isolation being tested for COVID-19 in the manner described by Dr. Bloomfield on June 9? And if not, how many individuals have not had the two tests the public were told would take place?
Mr. Speaker, the expectations of ministers and of myself are very clear that people will have those two tests in mandatory self-isolation. The second part of the member's question was how many people may not have had those tests to date. As he will know, that data has been requested. I have not yet received that data because I want it to be absolutely correct.
How many other cases, if any, are there where individuals have been released from managed isolation before a COVID-19 test result is known, where the individual subsequently tests positive for COVID?
Mr. Speaker, I am not aware of that having happened other than in cases that have been raised publicly.
Given his previous answers, will people who refuse to be tested for COVID-19 now be allowed to leave managed isolation after 14 days, notwithstanding that?
Mr. Speaker, the expectations are really clear. But I will say there's no evidence to date of any person coming out of managed isolation who has gone on to spread the virus into the community. The 14-day rule is done so because it is effective. The rationale for it is based on the incubation period of the disease, and it's the time from exposure to development of symptoms considered to be in the range of 1 to 14 days, but most commonly 3 to 7 days. And as such, that internationally agreed protocol is the thing that has been shown to work. The member's question, if there's some aspect I haven't answered, I'm happy for it to be repeated.
I'm just going to deal with an interjection then. Who made that loud interjection? Member will stand, withdraw and apologise.
I withdraw and apologise.
I just remind members, a member is not a long-term member, that that interjection is a reflection on me because it's my responsibility to ensure that that happens. The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Were the two women who tested positive for COVID-19 this week released from quarantine following personal representations advocating their early release from quarantine by National MP Chris Bishop?
Mr. Speaker, I am aware of that. Obviously, there have been representations made for compassionate leave from members of Parliament. I think people need to be very careful because these are sensitive matters necessarily.
Order. I'm going to hear the rest of this answer in silence. There's a very serious allegation that's been made here, and I want to hear the answer.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I am aware of that, and I just would ask members to be careful around these situations. On the one hand, people have been requiring or requesting that people be let go early out of these situations. On the other hand, we've seen the risks that that presents to New Zealanders and the team of 5 million and their efforts so far.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
A point of order, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
I'd like you to reflect on your commentary about the question from the Honourable Chris Hipkins as being a serious allegation. It kind of injects the Speaker into the question time in a way that a value judgment of that question might not stand scrutiny. Mr Bishop's advocacy for those people did not infer that an unsafe process should be followed. And the fact that you have effectively commented on the fact that it's a serious allegation is probably unhelpful.
Certainly unhelpful. Well, I should have said it's a serious matter and not a serious allegation. I'm not absolutely certain that the member's point of order has diminished it, but I will reflect on that.
Thank you. Supplementary. Does he agree with the Ministry of Health's statement around the COVID diagnosed sisters who were not tested that they have had no contact with anyone since their arrival in Wellington?
Mr Speaker, the most recent statement from the Ministry of Health is, I believe, the best information that we have to date.
Question number six, Dr Shane Reddy.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Health, was his management of PPE supplies during the coronavirus outbreak textbook? And how does that align with the report released by the Auditor General regarding management of personal protective equipment?
Mr Speaker, New Zealand's health response to the global pandemic has been world-leading. The Ministry welcomed the Auditor General's review of PPE, which found, quote, the Ministry moved quickly to set up a new centralised system for procuring, prioritising and distributing PPE stock, and this appeared to work well. The Ministry has confirmed it will implement the report's 10 recommendations, with work on 7 of them already underway.
Supplementary. Given the report's observations, was Ashley Bloomfield's comments accurate and correct when he said to Radio New Zealand at the time the outbreak was near its peak that PPE supplies are plentiful and steady and distribution is being made, quote, rock solid, unquote?
Mr Speaker, I haven't seen the detail of that quote, but obviously the system in the early stages had challenges. Anyone who reads that report will see that. But the Ministry did respond to those challenges, and there is, of course, then that praise in the report for the Ministry's response.
Supplementary. How does he justify his statement on May 7 when he said that Ashley Bloomfield's stocktake report did identify some initial teething issues that have now been resolved, when yesterday the OAG identified ongoing problems?
Mr Speaker, I think the statements speak for themselves. There are challenges in that supply. There is a globally competitive environment for PPE because COVID-19 is spreading at the fastest rate it has spread currently around the world. There is a global pandemic happening which is affecting supply chains around the world. Our response has been impressive in light of that global pandemic, but of course, there are always things we could do better, and we are working hard to make sure that risks are minimised and New Zealand's safety is put first.
Supplementary. Were the PPE issues not resolved then when on May 7th he said they were?
Mr Speaker, issues can be resolved before new issues arise. That's logical. And certainly the global situation continues to be challenging for securing PPE and other stocks necessary to combat a global pandemic.
Supplementary. Does he agree with the findings of the Auditor General that a degree of confusion appears to have arisen in relation to PPE? And if so, does he believe his decision to produce 36 separate PPE guidance documents contributed to this?
Mr Speaker, I believe that the report is right in saying that the Ministry responded appropriately by setting up a new centralised system for prioritising, allocating and distributing PPE stock. And also that the Ministry needed to act quickly to set up a centralised approach to managing national reserve stock levels, ordering, freight and distribution.
Supplementary. If his management of PPE is part of the textbook response that he has stated in this House many times, can he tell New Zealanders exactly which textbook he is referring to?
Mr Speaker, I would say, firstly, that management of the day-to-day operations is actually the responsibility of the Ministry of Health, not as the member characterises. And secondly, I would say just how wrong he is with that. His references to textbook are all, as far as I can find, through the Hansard in response to his questions framing the response as textbook. I don't know if he sees the irony in that. But I'll repeat to him a previous answer from the House. If you can read any textbook, it's liable to have a few challenges in it. And as we've heard recently, anecdotes of PPE in the early stages not getting to where they needed to go. That's why I'm seeking reassurance since we've stepped in to make sure that the system is working as it should.
Question number 7, Joe Luxon.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Education. What responses has he seen to apprenticeship boost?
Mr Speaker.
Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, I'm advised that the Apprenticeship Boost package, which provides employers with $1,000 per month for a first-year apprentice and $500 per month for a second-year apprentice, has been received extremely positively by businesses and industry groups. The CEO of the industry training organisation Competence, Fiona Kingsford, said she was delighted. The Motor Industry Training Association's Janet Lane said she wholeheartedly applauded the unprecedented announcement, even going so far as to say the government is showing leadership and significant goodwill to businesses taking on apprentices. While the Motor Trade Association's Chief Executive Craig Pomardy said that it was a great outcome for everyone.
What responses has he seen from businesses?
Speaker, I am informed that LT McGuinness's construction manager Sean McGuinness said on News Talk ZB that this will help an industry facing trade shortages in recent years. He said it's going to incentivise a lot of employers to take on new trainees and future-proof tradespeople in New Zealand for the next decade. Agricultural machinery supplier Landpower's John McDonald said that the apprenticeship boost, along with the removal of training fees, is a significant helping hand. He said it gives them confidence to keep their current apprentices and provides them with a much greater appetite to bring on more.
What reaction has he seen from farmers?
Mr Speaker, Chris Lewis from Federated Farmers acknowledged that one of the key problems facing farmers is the cost associated with taking on and training new staff, particularly those who are new to the sector. He said that the apprenticeship support program will make the transition and retention of new workers a lot easier, benefiting farmers, workers and the economy as we rebound from the effects of COVID-19.
Question number 8, Jamie Lee Ross.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Transport and asks, what projects, if any, in addition to those already listed in Schedule 2 of the COVID-19 Recovery Fast Track Consenting Bill did he propose as fast-track projects to improve transport in Auckland?
The Honourable Kiltwife. Mr Speaker, the Minister for the Environment has announced 11 initial infrastructure projects that will be fast-tracked under a new law to help rebuild the economy in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. This represents the best balance of rail and road and housing projects. The bill also opens the way for other projects to be fast-tracked to help deliver faster economic growth and more jobs as soon as possible. I'm advised by the Minister for the Environment that the initial plan was to include 4 to 6 projects so as not to slow down the implementation of the bill. In the end, Cabinet agreed on 11 projects, including the Britomart East upgrade, the Papakura to Pukekohe electrification, the Northern Pathway and the Papakura to Drury State Highway 1 roading upgrade. I'm advised that other projects proposed included Mill Road. KiwiRail also put forward the Wiri to Key Park segment of the Third Main, the Rail Network Growth Impact Management Project, and City Rail Link Works at Newmarket.
Are the projects listed in Schedule 2 the highest priority transport projects in his portfolio? If not, why did he not ensure other projects from the Auckland Transport Alignment Project or from his New Zealand Upgrade Program were included for fast-tracking?
Mr Speaker, that matter is one for the Minister of the Environment, who's responsible for the bill. I'm sure the member will understand that a range of criteria were used to determine the selection of projects, but I want to reassure the member
that our expectation is that this, the RMA fast-tracking legislation will be available to a much broader variety and a longer list of projects. And if the member has suggestions about additional projects, I'm sure the Minister for the Environment would welcome them.
If his government is open to further projects being fast-tracked, will he recommend to the Minister for the Environment amendments to Schedule 2 be supported, such as including the Eastern Busway or the Botany to Airport project to also be fast-tracked?
Well, the Eastern Busway is a fantastic project that will give people in Botany a congestion-free 40-minute ride between Botany and the Britomart. And while the first stage of the Eastern Busway is already underway, as the member knows, stages 2, 3 and 4 are now beginning. The procurement process is underway. And I'm very happy to have discussions and will with the Minister for the Environment about the potential for additional transport projects to benefit from the fast-tracking bill.
Michael Ward.
Is it possible that rail projects in Northland could be considered for fast-tracking under the bill? And if so, would the consideration of those projects be impacted by the negative comments about the value of rail in Northland by the local member at estimates hearings this morning?
Oh, Mr Speaker, the value of rail projects to actually future-proof our transport system and boost jobs and economies in our regions is far too important for us to be put off by the sort of the petty nitpicking of some members.
Question number 9, the Honourable Mark Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Defence. On what date and at what time was the decision made to give the Assistant Chief of Defence authority over all quarantine and managed isolation facilities, including the processes around the exit of those who had been in the facilities?
The Honourable Ron Mark.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Firstly, can I thank the member for asking me a primary question, first one since 30th of March last year.
Order. Order. That's not necessary.
Oh, sorry, Mr Speaker. My apologies. I have been advised that the decision, which I fully support and welcome, was made by the Prime Minister on the evening of 16th of June. There was an unacceptable failure of the system. As the Prime Minister stated, military precision, discipline, rigour and operational expertise was clearly needed, something that I have been consistently in support of throughout the entire COVID-19 response.
Order. Order. The question has been answered.
So why was a New Zealand Defence Force officer appointed to take over managed isolation facilities weeks before that date?
Could you say that again?
Okay, a bit louder, I think.
A bit louder, please.
So why was the New Zealand Defence Force's officer appointed to take over managed isolation facilities well before that date?
Oh, Mr Speaker, Air Commodore Digby Webb had been working in the CCO under the command of former Police Commissioner Mike Bush since about the 31st of March. He was seconded there in a role by the Chief of Defence Force. This recent elevation into a more senior position and a higher level of authority is a decision that's been made by the Prime Minister and, from what I understand, also from Mike Bush, who leads the OCC.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. Can I just seek your guidance? The Minister didn't answer my question at all. I asked him about a New Zealand Defence Force officer being appointed to take over the management of the isolation, self-managed isolation facilities. He hasn't responded to that question at all.
Well, I think he did. It mightn't satisfy the member, and it might leave some further supplementaries that he wants to ask. But as far as I'm aware, the gentleman concerned is a senior officer.
To the minister. To take over the managed isolation facilities.
Well,
I mean, there is an assertion in the question. I'll let it run. And the other point that I'll make to the member is that he has a very narrow primary question, which probably doesn't include that matter at all. But because there's clearly some interest from the opposition in whether or not someone else was appointed to that job before Digby, Air Commodore.
Air Commodore.
Yep. Then
yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I am struggling a little to understand precisely what the question is, but I might be able to shed some light and address the member's question in this way. Air Commodore Darren Webb has been in the Operational Control Centre.
No.
In that role.
No. Member will resume his seat. There was a pretty specific question and about someone other than that particular individual. And order. I'm on my feet. I'm not going to let the minister go on about the qualifications of someone who was in the primary question and therefore should be prepared for. But that's not who the question was asked about. And if the minister is not aware or disputes the assertion that's made, he should say that. But he doesn't need to go on about the qualifications of a person who's not the question's not about.
Well, I reject the premise of that question, Mr. Speaker.
Does he think it's good for New Zealand that because of government failures, our defence forces have been asked to police our civilian population?
Well, Speaker, once again, I reject the premise of that question. The defence forces have not been asked to police the civilian population by the Prime Minister. An officer who was in assisting with a particular role has simply been, for want of a better term, promoted in the field because he's done an outstanding job. Now the situation is instead of him assisting health officials, he is now leading in that particular role.
So can he clarify for the House then that the only thing that has changed is that they have appointed someone new to lead the response?
If the member's question is, has the officer concerned been promoted, the answer is yes. If the member's question is, has the Prime Minister identified some qualities, and indeed Mike Bush seems some qualities in this person who had a slightly less senior role, maybe, as a senior officer, into taking total responsibility now for the entire network of isolation facilities throughout New Zealand, he has taken total responsibility now at the direction of the Prime Minister. Congratulated for that.
So what has changed at our border in terms of managing our managed isolation and quarantine processes where we've seen multiple breaches? What has changed other than one person being put in charge of the response?
I think, Mr. Speaker, the member's a little confused. Air Commodore Digby Webb has not been put in control of the borders, actually. He has got a specific job around the quarantine facilities and the management of the personnel within that.
Will the minister now take responsibility for any further breaches now that he has one of his senior New Zealand Defence Force personnel in that role?
Speaker, I've been waiting since March to get asked some sensible questions. I'm still waiting.
Will the minister now take responsibility for any further breaches now that he has one of his senior New Zealand Defence Force personnel in that role?
Mr. Speaker, I'll take responsibility for the defence, anything that the Defence Force is engaged in, that is my responsibility. Right now, that senior officer, highly competent, very professional, who has been seconded into that role since the 31st of March, whose skill and expertise has been recognised by the Prime Minister, who's expressed such confidence in him and the Defence Force, has been promoted. Yeah, if I want to take responsibility for that, I'll do so. But I would say to that member, I have confidence in the New Zealand Defence Force. I have absolute total, and so too does this government, as has been indicated by the record levels of expenditure on defence platforms, on defence capability, and that officer in particular is the Assistant Chief Defence Force capability. capability. He has been at the core of some very substantial projects that have been run in the last 2 years, 2.5 years. I have total confidence in him, and I'll take responsibility for anything that comes out of that, including the credit.
Oh, for God's sake. Question number 10, Jamie Strange.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Trade and Export Growth. What actions has the government taken to increase trade with the United Kingdom and other countries?
The Honourable David Parker.
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand and the United Kingdom share a particularly close bond. We share a queen. We've both got a red, white and blue flag. And soon we'll have closer trade links. Yesterday, New Zealand became one of the first countries to begin negotiations for a FTA with the United Kingdom following Brexit, a high-quality, comprehensive and inclusive free trade agreement with the UK will also send a vital message about the importance of free and open trade rules more broadly with other countries.
So thank you. What outcomes does the government want to achieve from a trade agreement with the United Kingdom and others?
Mr. Speaker, what we're doing is creating opportunities for our exporters to earn more money, to employ more New Zealanders and to pay higher wages. We do this by improving the diversity of the export markets that they have lower tariff access to. We also want to make it easier for companies to trade through digital channels. This is particularly important in a post-COVID environment. We want to level the playing field between New Zealand exporters and exporters from other countries, some of whom have advantage compared with New Zealand. For example, kiwi fruit from some other countries have lower tariff rates into the European Union, including the UK at the moment. Mr. Speaker, we think overall this will be good. And through this agreement, we'll also address environmental challenges like climate change.
How will a high-quality trade agreement with the United Kingdom benefit New Zealanders?
Mr. Speaker, 1 in 4 New Zealanders' jobs depend on exports, and we know from statistics that exporting firms lift productivity at a faster rate. They employ more staff as a consequence of their export journey, and they pay better wages. So it's clear that trade can help drive our post COVID-19 economic recovery through creating jobs, boosting productivity and generating growth. And this New Zealand-UK FTA, like the New Zealand-EU FTA, will add to that journey.
Brett Hudson.
No, next question, Mr. Speaker.
Oh, sorry. Question number 11, Brett Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police. What police resources, if any, have been deployed to respond to incidents of people leaving COVID-19 quarantine or managed isolation facilities on compassionate grounds or prior to a COVID-19 test being returned?
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Mr. Speaker, police are one of a number of enforcement agencies that may be required to respond across government to incidents in relation to persons leaving a managed isolation facility on compassionate grounds prior to a COVID-19 test being returned. In this narrow example, I am advised that it is the Ministry of Health that will instruct police to assist them. Police will then make a decision about what steps they need to take to locate the person and facilitate their return. Decisions about police deployments are the responsibility of the Commissioner of Police, delegated to district commanders. But typically, police resources include managed isolation facility reassurance officers, district general duty frontline officers, iwi liaison and family liaison officers, police intelligence gathering staff, and inter-district operations to coordinate regional responses when required.
Very good.
Supplementary. Did police respond to an incident where a person had been released from a corrections facility and tested positive to COVID-19? And if so, how much time passed between police being notified and the person being located?
Well, Mr. Speaker, that is a very specific question. If the member had put that down in the primary, I might have come with that information. One thing I would say is it probably comes as no surprise that I did not receive nor seek a briefing on every police call out, of which there are approximately 3,250 per day.
Supplementary. Does he think there were adequate conditions in place for the reported cases of people leaving isolation to attend a mongrel mob tonguing in Hamilton who subsequently needed to be tracked down by police?
No, he's not responsible.
Okay.
What an amateur.
Supplementary. How many incidents that police have responded to at the behest of the Ministry of Health regarding locating close contacts of confirmed COVID-19 cases have police successfully located?
They have successfully located all of them.
Question number 12, Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Corrections. What reports, if any, has he seen of individuals transferred from COVID-19 managed isolation to a corrections facility who subsequently tested positive for COVID-19?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Mr. Speaker, during the various alert levels, I received daily updates from corrections regarding their management and response to COVID-19. I was also kept up to date with the progress of one individual who was transferred from COVID-19 managed isolation into Auckland Regional Women's Corrections Facility at 6:38 p.m. on the 29th of April 2020.
Supplementary, did the positive test for COVID-19 for that individual come back before or after the individual was released from the corrections facility?
Mr. Speaker, it may be helpful if I run through the timeline of what happened to this particular woman. So she returned to New Zealand from the United States on the 25th of April 2020 and refused to comply with lockdown at her accommodation in Auckland. She had refused to cooperate with staff, including submitting to a COVID-19 test she was not presenting as symptomatic. She was remanded. In other words, a judge made the decision. She was remanded on two active charges of obstructing, hindering a medical officer of health. The prisoner was received into Auckland Regional Women's Correction Facility at 6:38 p.m. on 29th of April. A decision was made to quarantine rather than separate the prisoner based on the health risk she presented. On the 5th of May, the prisoner was escorted to an AVL booth for a court appearance where she was remanded for a bail application on the 6th of May. On the 6th of May, the prisoner was escorted again to the AVL booth for a court appearance where she refused to listen to the judge and her counsel. On the 8th of May, at 2:40 p.m, the prisoner was escorted to the AVL booth for a court hearing and agreed to consent to the examination, in other words, the COVID test. At 4:38 p.m, she was escorted to the receiving office and released on bail, another decision made by the judge, with the condition that she was to go with the Geneva health team to the Siebel Hotel in Monaco and then be transported by her mother to a bail address in Palmerston North. It's important to understand that the judge made the decision for her to be bailed and corrections must comply with what the judge says. Now, Mr. Speaker, I take offence at the member across the way, David Bennett, saying that I direct judges to do anything. I do not have that capacity, that capability to direct judges to make decisions. What he is saying, and he has repeated it in this House, is an outright fabrication.
All right. No, before the member does, the whip will stand, withdraw and apologise.
Withdraw and apologise.
Did corrections staff notify the court that the individual had not yet received the results of their COVID-19 test before the individual was released?
Mr. Speaker, corrections did what the judge required of them to do.
Is the minister confident that there have been no additional cases of COVID-19 inside the corrections facility due to this positive case?
Mr. Speaker, I'm extremely confident in the processes that corrections took. The processes they put in place to manage COVID were exemplary. There were no cases other than this woman that came into corrections All staff were required to wear PPE. All people entering prison were kept separate. And the fact that, unlike jurisdictions overseas, we have not had a case arise, other than this one that was imported from the United States, it goes down to the great work that corrections did to prevent the spread of COVID in our prisons.
Jenny Anderson.
What reports, if any, has the Minister received on the way corrections managed its response for COVID-19?
Mr Speaker, corrections officers were part of our country's essential services during our response to COVID-19 and did a spectacular job. The Chief Ombudsman wrote to the Chief Executive of Corrections this week following organised visits and thanked them for keeping the inspectors safe. He shared that, I have been very impressed by the cohesive and well-resourced response put in place to manage the impacts of COVID-19 in prisons. You and your staff are to be commended, unquote. As the Minister, I commend them as well.
That concludes our questions.